Mr. Bishoner was thirsty. Did you like going to school? How about you guys? Do you like going to school? You do sometimes, yeah, that's good. Good answer. How about the rest of you? How many of you enjoyed going to school? Mr. Dwornick liked going to school. We'll have to call some of his boyhood chums to find out if that's actually true or not. We've got some that actually do know that he did go to school. I think we're pretty sure that he did go to school. How many of you didn't like going to school? Now, be honest. It's okay. I mean, okay, that's right. Good, good. That's honesty is good policy. You can leave now, all of you. Just raise your hands. I wrote in my notes, I bet a few of you probably didn't like going to school. Probably the case. One of the greatest joys of my young childhood was a day when a teacher rewarded me for my hard work. There were times when I did work hard, yes, that's true, in school. Because I was promoted, and this may not apply now in today's school systems, they may not do it in this way, but reading was a very important subject all through elementary school. You know, reading, writing, arithmetic, all the bases. I don't know if they teach those things anymore, but reading was a very important part. Reading and understanding what you read was a very important part, right? Mr. LaRavia, wasn't that a part of the curriculum? And everybody else that's my age or maybe a little bit younger, reading was very important. And I was a good reader. I was an avid reader. There were things that I wasn't so good at. I wasn't great at math, but that seems to be the case with a lot of people. But reading was something that I developed a love for about third or fourth grade, and I really worked hard at it. But for some reason, I got kind of pigeonholed, even though I knew I was better. I got pigeonholed in the second level reading group. We had the highest reading group, the second group, most of the first reading group, there were girls mostly. The second reading group, some of the rest of us, and then the third reading group, I guess the people could barely read, so they spent a lot of time with them. But I knew I was better than where I had been placed, and I worked very, very hard. I really did love to read, and about the third to fourth grade, I fell in love with biographies of famous people, whether they were presidents or athletes. They had biographies written for the third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade level, and bigger words, I mean, bigger in sized font, you know, less words on the page and everything. But still, reading about these famous people or people who had overcome hardship was one of the things that really inspired me as a youth. And so I read, and in reading class, I don't know if they did this when you were in school, but you read out loud, and everybody got their turn to read out loud. And so your promotion, or the promotion that I received, was my ability to read out loud, which is a good practice that we teach in Spokesman's Club and Graduate Club, that reading out loud is a good thing to do to help your speech pattern and so on and so forth. So I became a very good reader, but it was kind of lost on a lot of teachers until I got to the fifth grade. And this teacher saw that I was good and that I was really should be promoted. And when I was promoted, I can tell you this, that is probably the happiest day of my elementary school life. I was really proud of my achievement, and I was excited because it had been recognized by a teacher. And I literally was on a cloud walking home to tell my mother that I had been promoted. And it's amazing that one little tiny thing, as an adult, you wouldn't even guess how important that would be. But to me as a kid, it fueled my love for learning for many years afterwards because it was a proof and a certainty that I could do the work. And a teacher recognized that, and I was so happy. That teacher, my fifth grade teacher, never knew, I'm very certain, never, ever knew the amount of joy that I had. And as a little kid, how can you really have the maturity of mind to communicate that to a teacher afterwards? Wouldn't you love to be with the mind that you have now, go back in time and just be able to be a little kid again, maybe, and do all the things that you've thought of. Man, wouldn't it be cool if I could do this and recognize that person for doing this for me and that sort of thing? But you can't. But she didn't know how thrilled I was. When I was in the 11th grade, I wrote a paper for an assignment in English class. It was, I think the topic was, it was kind of open-ended in this sense, but the topic was what America means to me. And my essay, I basically wrote around, and we're talking 1969 now, kind of a turbulent time in our country, a time of rebellion and that sort of thing that was going on, as many of you remember at that time. And basically the summation of my paper, I didn't keep it, but the summation of my paper was this, that in America, anybody could achieve whatever they wanted, regardless of their station in life. Now, I'm saying it more eloquently than I did in my 11th grade mind. I'm saying it that better now than I did then. And I can't remember what the mark that I got on that essay was. I can't remember if it was either an A minus, it was between an A minus, I think, and a minus something. So I'm thinking either A minus or B minus, but I can't remember exactly what it was. It would be okay if it was a B minus, but I remember, you know, how they used to grade your papers and the red ink that they'd write in, and always hard to read the red ink. But the English teacher wrote at the top, "Do you really believe that? Do you really think that's true?" Now, I don't know if she was challenging me and trying to get me to think, because that's the role of a teacher sometimes, right? To challenge you in such a way that you'll, you know, they may disagree with you and challenge you to either make you stand up for your beliefs or to actually help you to think and maybe think through this process. Okay. So I don't know if she gave me a high mark or a low mark. B minus would be a low mark in my opinion, but passing certainly. But that's what I felt at the time. And that's how my father had lived his life and my mother had lived her life. She was an immigrant to this country. She came from Scotland, and she had to work hard all her life, and she was proud to be an American. But at any rate, like me, I'm sure you'd like to go back with some teachers, either the good ones or the bad ones, and have a heart-to-heart discussion with them and either tell them how great they were, or maybe they could have chosen a different profession before they taught you. There are some of my teachers that I really, really highly respected. They motivated me. They encouraged me. They stimulated me. And some I'd rather not like to ever see again, and I haven't. So I guess we're even, them and me. They didn't like me. I didn't like them. A teacher I had in 11th grade, another teacher, encouraged my love for history and the study of politics. I think history was more or less the instigator for becoming interested in the political system and that sort of thing. And we had a political science class in 11th grade. That he was a good teacher, and he was also the history teacher of a class that I took. And in 11th grade, I was chosen from my school to attend what was called then the Presidential Classroom for Young Americans. And these were students from all over the United States who were chosen to go to Washington, D.C. For some of them, that was a big trip. If they lived in Oregon, they flew out. For me, it was a 40-mile drive that my dad took me down to the Shore Motel in Washington, D.C. and dropped me off. And you know, I stayed there for a week. And then we went around to all of the various government departments. We met with our local congressman at the time at the Capitol building. I remember he was kind of a big guy with an incredibly firm handshake. He'd make Nate Gatlin kind of cringe a little bit with his handshake being so powerful. But he's, you know, had a massive hand. I remember him taking me into his office and having a chat with me about what I wanted to do with my future in life and if I was interested in politics and all that sort of thing. It was a very interesting environment. And again, it was something that attending that and being chosen to attend by that teacher from my school to attend that was something that fueled, I think, my interest in history and politics later on in life. So very possibly like you, I had some teachers that stood out. Now, let's think about the good ones now, not the bad ones. They provided an environment for learning. A number of years before his death for the Church of God, Herbert Armstrong described a foundational objective for everyone in the Church of God, and it remains true today. And that foundational objective was that you are going to become a teacher, and you are a teacher in training right now, because you are going to be a teacher during the time of the millennium. So every one of you that is sitting here right now has the capacity to be a great teacher. You do. You are going to be that person that will inspire hundreds, maybe multiple thousands of people, because you will be an outstanding teacher. I know each and every one of you that are sitting here will become an outstanding teacher. And how do I know that? Because you have been chosen and called of God. A number of years ago, Mr. Armstrong described to an audience in the auditorium about a foundation that we had set up in Jordan for mentally retarded children and school of mentally retarded children. And we were training some of our Ambassador College students to go over to Jordan. You may remember this, Mr. LaRavia, and to help teach these and teaching other people within Jordan to help within this school. And he mentioned, you know, why don't we just open it up and just to everybody that has the need. There was just a small group of cadre of students that they could teach and help them, you know, from childhood to become active adults who could take care of themselves in a better way. And he said the problem was not just so much the money or the finances, but having enough qualified teachers to be able to help all of those that needed the help. It doesn't do any good to bring in everybody that has the need if you don't have the ability to help teach them. And the analogy that he used, or the comparison that he used, was that in the world tomorrow, as we have called it, the thousand-year reign of Christ, we are going to need excellent teachers, because God is calling you to be an outstanding teacher, a teacher. Now, when you consider the role of a teacher, there is probably no higher calling. And you've got to, while you're hearing the words that I speak, you've got to put out of your mind maybe some of the stereotypical thoughts regarding teachers. And you've got to put back into your, because oftentimes, if you can't do, you teach. That's the saying. It's not exactly true, really, when you get down to the excellent teachers and the people that have sacrificed to the point, and it's not as highly regarded a profession in our society as it probably should be. And it doesn't always attract the best and the brightest, as we know. But in terms of how they should be compensated, they probably should be compensated at the high end of the pay scale, rather than, and we spend so much on administration, we spend more money on the, in this country on, in quote, education, but too little of it on the salaries to attract people that are really gifted and really could do a great job with our children. So you have to put some of that out of your mind and think about that special teacher in your life that was so outstanding to you that maybe that was the one person that actually kept you in school and kept you motivated, and at least inspired you later in life to say, oh, I kind of regret that I didn't really put out all the effort that I should have done, but now at least they taught me some things that I can use in my life. Now, that's the person that you need to think of as a type or a role model in your head. Now, I thought of, while I was preparing the sermon, I thought of immediately a few people who I regard today as individuals who are outstanding teachers, and I'll go over some of their qualifications and the qualifications of outstanding teachers in just a bit. But strangely enough, I think of Mr. Wilson. Who is Mr. Wilson? Mr. Wilson is my granddaughter Haley's kindergarten teacher. Can you imagine how much patience and ability to motivate you've got to have if you've got 20 or 25 kindergarten kids in a class, and you're teaching them those basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic. Anybody that has babysat their own grandchildren knows how challenging one can be. But my granddaughter went to her first day of kindergarten last September or August, whenever it was, and she wanted me to be with her there, and it was so cute to get them all in the car, Jared, the dad, in the back seat, and Haley in her safety seat in the back seat. And for several weeks, since she's been about 3 years old, she's wanted to go to school. She wanted to go to school with her cousin, Lacey. She's wanted to go, and Lindsay has even gotten her, and I think we've kind of chipped in and gotten some teaching materials so that she can have a blackboard and a whiteboard to write on. She's been doing that. She's been playing going to school. And Lindsay started reading to her so much that she actually began to read when she was 3 or 4, and she's got now a second grade reading level at kindergarten age. But she's really doing well, and Mr. Wilson is one of those. But anyway, we're going to school, and for the weeks leading up to it, she was so excited. She wanted to go to school. Then they went to school to have a pre-meeting with the teacher, and then she saw what school was all about. And then for the next couple of weeks before school actually started, there was that normal apprehension that began to set in. It was kind of heartrending for a grandparent to watch all of this happen. And then, they continued to work with her and prepare her. And it was so funny that she said this, knowing this apprehension, we got in the car, taking a couple miles away to go to the school. And Lindsay looks back and she says, "You okay, baby?" And she says, very dogmatically, "I am not afraid." It's like she's trying to convince herself. You know, it was so funny. But she's really enjoyed this first year of school. And Mr. Wilson is just an outstanding teacher and really an incredible, incredible role model and a person as well. Another person that I think of when I think of an outstanding teacher that I know now is Dr. Jeffrey Liss. And he's a faculty member of the College of Medicine in the rheumatology department. He is really, I've heard him speak and give lectures probably 36 times, I would guess, and sometimes the same lecture, because he was used by my company to be a promotional speaker, and he's very even and balanced, but had wit, had humor, had encouragement in describing and helping teach other doctors. I don't know of anybody any better. And to place an emphasis on that, very recently, he was hired away from the College of Medicine to come work for my company. Not that I had anything to do with it. I had nothing to do with it, but he is such an outstanding teacher that they are going to use him in the position of what they call medical fellowship. So he'll teach a lot of other doctors in the growing field of rheumatology. I had the experience this past week, something really topical and on my mind, was that one of my business partners had scheduled a breakfast program for some other doctors at a large group of internal medicine, and she brought down a endocrinologist from the Phoenix area, who is very gifted teacher. And he has his own practice. He's in private practice. But he was basically telling the doctors about how to use a particular product and where they might use it and what kind of patient they might. And so there were 6 doctors in this practice, and they all came back one by one during the breakfast hour. We provided the breakfast, the speaker, they came back. And so for 6 very different individuals, and I mean in terms of personality, he had to start all over again and quickly gauge and assess their interest level, gauge their personality type, and tailor that same message for each one in a slightly different way to make it something that was helpful to them. And when I was driving him back to another program for another partner, business person to pick him up, I said, you have an outstanding gift, and you guys would be able to know, and he wouldn't know, but you would know that I would have an appreciation for somebody that can do a good job in public speaking, and so could any of our guys that have gone to Spokesman's Club, and probably all of you who have sat and listened to sermons through the years. There's a certain gift for conveying that knowledge And that is what being a teacher is all about. We had a trainer when I went back to Indianapolis who is a field-based trainer from New York City. And he was our main trainer for my class of 14 people when I went through training with Lily, Bobby Brown. So I'll give a shout-out to Bobby Brown, who's an outstanding teacher. He doesn't know I'm doing it, but I just feel like I can go ahead and say that. He was a really an outstanding teacher. So unfortunately, the high calling of being a teacher is often obscured by the various school systems, not just in this country, but around the world. We've tried to get it right, tried to do a better job. Most of the time we don't in our various societies. But all of us know the joy of learning, like I experienced when I was walking home after being promoted to the first. It sounds like such a little thing, right? Being promoted to the first grade reading level, so insignificant, but what a massive change one little bit of encouragement can make in one person's life. You know that kind of joy that I'm speaking about, and all of you have been called to be that kind of teacher. Notice Revelation chapter 5. See, I've taken 21 minutes here to get to the first scripture. Let's see, I don't think I have 20 scriptures. I don't think it'll take me 21 minutes in between each one. Well, Revelation chapter 5 and verse 9. Angelic beings now are very excited as they're seeing what is happening. And John is able to witness this. And the translators of the Bible could not comprehend that this could apply to human beings. So they switched the pronouns, which are not there. They added in the wrong pronouns, which are not there in the original Greek. And so we know what God's plan is. We know what he's doing with you, with me, with all of us that he has called. And so we can replace the pronouns here. So these angelic beings are erupting into a new song. And they sang a new song saying, "You, Jesus Christ," being the "you," "are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals." This book was sealed. It was a sealed book. No one could open it. Not any of the angels, only Jesus Christ. "For you were slain and have redeemed." I don't know if you mark your Bible, but if you've got a pencil and you've never changed this and you really want this to make sense, cross out "us" and put in "them." Because that's how it should read. "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and have redeemed them to God." Not us, not the angelic beings who are singing the song. They have no redemption. "By your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and have made them kings and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth." They wouldn't be singing that about themselves. How rude would that be? They're singing about the called, the chosen, the faithful ones, as mentioned elsewhere in this book. Being a king and a priest is really nothing more than being a teacher with a lot of influence. Verse 1 of chapter 5 gives a short description of this Jesus Christ. "And I saw him, and I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll written inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. Then I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose its seals?' And no one in heaven or on the earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look at it. So I wept much," John said, "because no one was found worthy to open and read the scroll or to look into it. But one of the elders, one of these angelic beings surrounding the throne room of God, said to me, 'Do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed to open the scroll and to loose its seven seals.'" So this book and the mysteries contained therein were revealed to John. And Jesus Christ opened up the scrolls and give us the meaning of this rest of the book. So we will reign on this earth as teachers, kings, and priests whose primary duty is to serve, assist, and teach others. Now, you're probably already ahead of me to a certain degree, but what are some of the common qualities of great teachers? Let's see how you do compared to this list that I have assembled. I didn't try to come up with a specific number, but I did do a little research and a little thinking of myself. So let's see how you do. Okay? A great teacher has a passion and love for learning. Check. You have that, right? An engaging personality. Check. Well, some of you do, I think. I've got a little smiley face by this one. Knowledge of the subject. Check, right? High expectations of their students. In other words, a great teacher who really motivates well expects them to work hard, expects them to achieve their best potential, whether it's the second reading level or the first reading level. A great teacher has high expectations for all of their students and expects them to work hard. Check. Has a great regard and respect for their students. That one I found. That great teachers have great respect and high regard. And when you think about it, doesn't that resonate so well with you? Can't you think of the best teachers that you ever had, that when they came into the classroom, it wasn't, here I am, this wonderful, great teacher, and I have all of this knowledge, and there you, you lowly scum, you know nothing, I'm going to have... No, they have high regard for the intelligence of their audience and for their students. They're encouraging to their students. Check. You're an encouraging person, aren't you? And they have great personal integrity. Now, I found lists, the 25 top qualities of teachers, the 9 top qualities of teachers, the 10 qualities of a good teacher. I found all those things, but these are the ones that really stand out in every list. And it may not be the best one. You may think of some other things. So these are a few of the important qualities of being a good teacher. And while you may feel it's a daunting task regarding someone who's going to be responsible for teaching others, and you will be, so you can't get out of it, just bear in mind that because you have the calling of God in your life, that this is something you can't escape. I really wasn't good at school. I can't do this. You can do it. You will do it, and you're going to have fun doing it. You're going to have so much fun being a great teacher. Turn to the book of Hebrews, and the book of Hebrews is where we'll spend a lot of time today. And I'm going to, I'm not going to claim to be a great teacher, but I'm going to challenge you as great teachers do. And I'm going to say that since after this potluck, you'll have like roughly, by the time you get home, you'll have roughly 4 hours before sundown. You're going to have plenty of time to study this book and to kind of flesh out what I can't give to you today. Certainly, you can read the book within that period of time. It's going to be so simple for you to do that. So I'll not claim to be a great teacher, but as a great teacher would do, I'm going to challenge you to go through this, to kind of fill in the spaces, the things that we can't really touch upon. Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 12, the author is mildly chiding his audience or his class. He's showing that he has high expectations of them when he says to them in verse 12, "For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God, and you have come to need milk and not solid food." Now, a lot of times we have tried to relate that in a modern sense, and I'm not sure that we've always done the best job in doing so. So I want you to put out anything modernistic, you know, that anybody's ever said that, you know, you're a member of the audience and, you know, hey, you're not a good teacher yet. You've become need of, you need to start over again. You're just a babe in the faith, blah, 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 blah. Whatever you may have heard in the past, I don't want you to think about that because I've already set the expectation very high for you by saying that you all have the capacity to be a great teacher. I want you to think about this verse and think of it strictly right now. I'm not saying it doesn't have a modern application at some other time, but I want you to think for the purposes of today's lesson, I want you to think of this strictly as an admonition to the audience that the author is addressing at that time. Is that clear? Okay, so he's telling a certain group of people that they need to relearn. Now they're just beginning. They hadn't gotten it. They need to start over. They should have known better. They should have been more advanced than they were, but they weren't. It goes on to talk about solid food, and you know, you have all the spiritual analogies between the milk of the word later on in the general epistles, and you know, so on and so forth. So, but they needed to learn the first principles of the oracles of God. And in Romans, you may want to hold your place there if you've got one of the little do thingies that keep you there. You may want to hold your place there and turn to Romans and chapter 3 and beginning in verse 1. Because now we know who wrote this book. It was Paul. He says he wrote it in the first chapter. So we're very sure that Paul wrote this. He said, "What advantage then has the Jew? Or what is the profit of circumcision?" Well, much in every way. Much. There's a great advantage to being Jewish, he said. Chiefly because to them were committed the oracles of God. The oracles of God. Now, what was that? Again, you may want to hold your place there in the book of Hebrews. And let's go back to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verses 5 through 8. Deuteronomy, kind of a, I hate to use this word, rehash of the law before they went into the promised land, but a restatement. Deutero, meaning a repeat of what had been previously given. So, Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 5. I was going to say that's wrong. Wow. It's in the wrong chapter. It's in chapter 5. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 5. "Therefore, be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who will hear all these statutes and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people.' For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, for whatever reason we may call upon him? And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before you this day?" The oracles that the Jews had been given were the laws and the statutes, and you could add to that the writings and the prophets under the Old Covenant, the Old Testament. And they had that advantage, Paul tells the Romans. They had the knowledge of this information. People have added to that. The oracles could have also included the unwritten instruction about other things. But at least we know that they had the law and they had all of that to guide and direct them and to inspire them. And so there was that advantage. Now, throughout the rest of the book of Romans, Paul shows that in one sense, none of that really matters. It doesn't really mean that you're a lesser person if you're a Gentile, because Galatians 6:16, I think I've explained this before, all will be of Israel, the Israel of God. All will be of God and of the Israel of God. They will all be together. There will be no differentiation. So if you're Italian, or if you're Polish, or if you're from some other tribe or group of people, it doesn't really matter. You've been called to be a teacher in Israel, just as Jesus told Nicodemus. You call yourself a teacher? That's the intent, really. In John 3, you call yourself a teacher of Israel? You have been called to be a great teacher, a great motivator, somebody that will inspire students, somebody that won't do it for them, but will inspire them to do it themselves in the same way. So what the writer of Hebrews is saying to these folks, it's not as though they really didn't have knowledge. It's not as though they had a long ways to go, but there was a missing element and they were not skillful. They should have been enthusiastic. They should have been passionate about their faith. They should have been able to communicate that enthusiasm to others and be teachers, because that's all that teachers do. They communicate their passion, their enthusiasm, their excitement for learning and truth to the students, and try to convey that same kind of enthusiasm to their listeners. And that's what was missing from their lives, because they were lacking something. They were, despite all the knowledge, the oracles, the law of God, the writings, their knowledge of the prophets and everything else, they were lacking a vital key. What was it? What did they lack? Have you wondered about that? They had to be lacking in something, because the author is showing us that they were lacking in something. And just by understanding the terminology Hebrews, you understand that he wasn't writing to the Galatians here. He wasn't writing to the people in Cappadocia here. He's writing to a specific group of people that are called Hebrews. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean it was just the Jews. It could have meant the Jews. It could have meant others, including, like Paul himself, as we'll get to, was of the tribe of Benjamin. It could have been others. It could have been the Levitical priesthood included here as well. In fact, I'm sure that it did include some of those in the Levitical priesthood who were in Jerusalem. It doesn't mean that this book only went to the Hebrews in Jerusalem. It could have gone to a wider audience than that. But the main thing is, we know that these were the people who were descendants of the 12 tribes. Maybe it was fewer than all 12. Maybe it was inclusive. We don't know. But they should have had something, but they were lacking. So let me address this question. Who wrote the book of Hebrews? We try to be very careful not to just dogmatically say that it was Paul who wrote the book of Hebrews, because it doesn't say that Paul wrote the book of Hebrews, and he identifies himself in all the other letters, right? He identifies himself. But except for one other person here, I think. No, two other people here. I went to Ambassador College. Just wanted to pull rank there a little bit. Doesn't mean anything. But no, I just said that for the point of that when we were in Epistles of Paul class, we were told, and it was included in the curriculum of all of the Pauline epistles, as they're called, the book of Hebrews was covered, and we had assumed that it was written by the Apostle Paul. That's what we came to. Not we, but that's what the Church of God has unofficially taught. I guess we can't officially teach it because it doesn't dogmatically say, but why did we ever say that, or why were we taught? And that the teacher of that class, who I won't mention, was a very good teacher. And I had a very good, maybe that instruction that gave at the beginning of the service, you need to repeat that, I told that instructor that we knew that golf was around during Paul's day. He said, what? I said, well, yeah, Paul said he finished his course. I mean, come on, you and I are both golfers. We know that he must have written this after the 18th hole. So, anyway, here are a couple of reasons that lead us to believe that maybe it was Paul, okay? Just very quick, easy things to remember. Because many times, and turn to Hebrews 13 and verse 18, and let's take a look at what may be to some people. I don't really care who you believe wrote the book of Hebrews. It doesn't really matter to me. I don't, you know, but it is an interesting sidelight, because certainly if it was Paul, he could have certainly had the capability. In verse 18, he says, pray for us, for we are confident that we have a good conscience in all things, desiring to live honorably. That's very much like what Paul would say and how he said it in other books. Now, it may not have been Paul. It could have just copied the style, or maybe just the way it turned out. But Paul did ask for the ones that got his letters to pray for him, and often refers to a clean conscience. And I've got a bunch of scriptures I could throw out at you. I'm not going to do it for the sake of time. Send me a note. I'll send you the notes. How's that sound? Send me an email. I'll send you the notes. I've also got copies of the notes today if you want to look at that. So the author also asked the Hebrews that he might be restored to them sooner in verse 19. But I especially urge you to do this, that I may be restored to you the sooner. So what does that mean? Paul also wrote to the Philippians and to Philemon in the same manner. And then there are also some of these expressions in verse 20. Now may the God of peace, Paul uses that expression in some of his other books, and grace be with you all in verse 25 at the closing. Those also appear in Romans, Thessalonians, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians as his closing. And it is also, notice this in verse 23, know that our brother Timothy has been set free, with whom I shall see you if he comes shortly. So brother Timothy was set free. Others could have been familiar with Timothy. That's true. It's entirely possible. Could have been Barnabas. But oftentimes he's associated with Paul. And in verse 24, greet all those who rule over you and all the saints. Those from Italy greet you. Now we know this, that Paul spent several years under house arrest in Rome. So, now it may not have been Paul. There are, you know, some arguments against. I won't go heavily into those, but one of the arguments is that, the writer of this book must have been a second generation Christian, because it says in Hebrews 2 and verse 3, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed to us by those who heard him? So the idea is that this is, since Paul was trained, and you find this in Galatians, since Paul was trained by Christ personally in Arabia, find out in the first chapter that this probably wasn't Paul, because this person, whoever it was taught by some of the original apostles and not necessarily by Christ himself. But that doesn't necessarily mean that in verse 3, because Paul did go up to Jerusalem in Acts 15 for the council meeting in Acts 49 AD when they held that meeting, and he conferred with the original apostles there. So, be that as it may, that's one of the arguments. But what is so striking about this book of Hebrews, and the one thing that can enable you to be a great teacher, the one thing that they were missing, what is it? It's a key that's here that helps you to unlock the puzzle of why this book is so important. And today, in the 4 hours between after the potluck, getting home, and sunset, or if you prefer to go beyond, that's fine with me, you can either validate or destroy my premise or hypothesis. But before I get to that key, if you carefully study the tone and the tenor of this book, you'll find all of the qualities of a great teacher, and the ones that I've already mentioned. A passion and a love for learning is very evident within the writings of this book and the author's intent. You do find the evidence of a very engaging personality, a very engaging personality. Certainly, without a doubt, the knowledge of the topic and the subject matter at hand, he is intimately acquainted with. And as you'll see, he has really high expectations for his students. He really does. And he's highly complimentary of them and encouraging of them. And he expects them to work hard. And he has great regard and respect for his students. He motivates a little bit with the stick and with the carrot. You've seen the stick approach in Hebrews 5:12. You should be better than this now. You should be better teachers, more, you know, you should be able to digest solid food. But he's encouraging to them, and he's obviously got great personal integrity. Notice Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 9. He says, "But beloved, we are confident of better things concerning you." Teacher standing in front of a class and telling them after they'd all failed a test, "You can do better than this. You just didn't study." I was visiting with my granddaughter the other day, and I said, "Are you into math yet? Are you studying math?" And she said, "Yep." I said, "Do you do addition?" She says, "Yep." I said, "Do you do subtraction?" She said, "Yep." So I made 3 10 question tests for her. Kindergarten. I couldn't do these when I was in third grade, I don't think. You know, but they were pretty simple addition questions, 2 plus 2, 2 plus 5, 5 plus 6, blah blah. So, and then some minuses as well. And so 3 tests, and she got 3 wrong out of 30 in the addition and subtraction questions that I posed to her. And she was excited about it. She had been given a test. Tests, we dreaded tests. We dreaded those tests, right? Oh, no, I don't want the tests. The fear of taking a test is one of the most common things that people have. And I had to take, when I went through training this last time for a month and a half, I had to take like 15 tests. Some of them were 20 questions. Some of them were 40. Failure was 85% or less. You had to get them right. And then the really meaningful test, and you had to pass them before you went to Indianapolis. You had to pass them. They were online. Multiple choice. People say, "Oh, multiple choice. Those are easy. You know, just guess C." No. No. You don't get, there's no guesswork in this work at all. You know, I went to Indianapolis, had to take 3 tests the first day of class. The first thing we did. Okay. Here's your iPads. We're loaded the tests onto them, and you got to take them and you got to submit them. And okay, guess what? If you don't pass with 85% or better, you're coming back tomorrow, and it's going to be pretty obvious if you don't pass, because you're going to be the only one in class, not in class. You'll be down somewhere in another room being proctored and taking these exams. So anyway, but she loved to take the tests. I'm really happy about that. Boy, I hope we can keep that going. The writer, I'll just say, if it's Paul, it's Paul. He was telling them that not only did he have high expectations and great regard for them, but they are constantly under a test as individuals. And in verse 10, he says, "For God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love, which you have shown toward his name, in that you have ministered to the saints and do minister." So he has a high regard and great concern for them, but he is warning them of potential problems on the horizon, because he says in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 9, he's warning them of some things that could happen to them. "Do not be carried about with various and strange doctrines, for it is good that the heart be established by grace, not with foods which have not profited those who have been occupied with them." A reference to, obviously, some of the things that we've been talking about since the beginning of the year, in some of the sermons and things that we've mentioned about some of the problems that were going around in the Christian world in the first century A.D. And what were some of the strange doctrines of the time? We've covered them, that Jesus wasn't really a human being, that he wasn't God, that he didn't become a human being. That was a strange doctrine, that he was some kind of phantom or that he was an angel, and that the resurrection was past was another one, and then all kinds of wacky ideas regarding foods that had been offered in sacrifice to idols and some of the things that were associated with the pagan dairy. But that was not the issue with these Hebrew people. But notice Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 12. Another warning. There are a lot of warnings in the book of Hebrews. Hebrews 3 and verse 12. But beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief and departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through deceitfulness of sin. Again, so they're a group that knew the oracles of God. They were exposed to them, but that doesn't necessarily grant you access into God's kingdom. In Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 4, for it is impossible for those who are once enlightened and have tasted the heavenly gift and have become partakers of the Holy Spirit and have tasted the good word of God and the powers of the age to come, if they fall away, to renew them again to repentance, since they crucify again for themselves the Son of God and put him to an open shame. There is the danger of falling away, and the stakes are high. The stakes are high for all of us at all times. In the book of Hebrews in chapter 4 and verse 11, just across your page, the author says, let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall according to the same example of disobedience. He's talking about the ancient Israelites who did fall. For the word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit and of the joints and marrow, and as a discerner of the thoughts and the intents of the heart. We can't be like those in the wilderness, the author is saying. They had every advantage. They were given the law. They were given the oracles of God. But they fell because of disobedience. The author is pleading with them now. Don't be like that. Being born into Israel doesn't confer some kind of magic power to you. As a matter of race, the calling of God has prerequisites for every one. Because he says in chapter 4 and verse 1 that you are called, they weren't. That is, thousands of years now ago, that group, that nation was not called to salvation. Verse 1, therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear, lest any of you seem to come short of it. For indeed, the gospel, the good news, the oracles of God was preached to us as well as to them, but the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith to those who heard it. Faith comes from the Spirit of God. They were not called to salvation at that time. Romans brings out that they will, that all Israel will be saved in Romans 11. They all will be saved during the great white throat judgment. You have been called, he says, to salvation, to this group of people, whether they were all the tribes or just the Jews, the Levites, the Benjamites. You've been called this group. So what is the key, more than any other, that can help you to understand this letter and what it's saying to the recipients and what they have to get in mind and what gets them away from being categorized as milk and being able to take in solid food? Now, some believe that this letter was actually a sermon that was transcribed and then sent to those intended. And when you look at the way it's laid out, that's certainly possible. It's possible it could have been a sermon transcribed and sent out. Pretty long sermon. They had longer sermons back then, if that's the case. But let's consider the audience. Before I get to the key, I'm going to try to wrap this up here in a little bit. It's addressed to Hebrews. It could be mainly the Jews of the day who had been called into the church, or even some other tribes who were conversant with the law and probably had been converted by what we now call, in today's age, it wasn't called that then, Judaism. Judaism. Galatians. Some quick scriptures here. We'll leave Hebrews for just a second. But Galatians chapter 1 and verse 13. Notice what Paul says about himself. For you have heard of my former conduct in Judaism. I guess it was used as terminology then. How I persecuted the church of God beyond measure and tried to destroy it. And I advanced in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries in my own nation, being more exceedingly zealous for the traditions of my fathers. He was conversant in the law. Romans chapter 11 and verse 1. Another attestment to his own training. Romans 11 and verse 1. I say then, has God cast away his people? Certainly not. For I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. And then Philippians chapter 3. Philippians 3 verses 4 and 5. Something else Paul says about himself. Though I might have confidence in the flesh, if anyone else thinks he may have confidence in the flesh, I more so. Circumcised the eighth day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, concerning the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, concerning righteousness which is in the law, blameless. This is Paul. Now, for those Hebrews, back to the book of Hebrews, we're going to close this up here quickly now. So, for those Hebrews, what were some of the most important parts of their faith? In the middle of the book, the author cites some of the most important things regarding their faith. And it had to do with physical things. Physical things that he shows are counterparts of spiritual things. In Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 1, he says, then indeed, even the first covenant had ordinances of divine service in the earthly sanctuary. He's talking about the tabernacle in the wilderness. That was something that God established with great detail. He told Moses how to construct this and gave him all the blueprint for how to do that. And then gave the same blueprint later on to David so that the temple, which would replace the tabernacle in the wilderness, could be built. And what did it all point to? The throne room of God. The very throne room where the Godhead sits. Where God alone resides, where no one else is allowed, even from a physical standpoint, except for that high priest one time a year on the Day of Atonement. Only then, after purification in many different ways, could that one person, that high priest, physical high priest, even approach or go into the holy of holy areas, surrounded by cherubim, representing the angels that are in God's throne room. That's what it is all describing in Hebrews, and you have to fill in the gaps yourself later today, perhaps. I don't know if you want to, but the tabernacle, the service, the altar, the sacrifices. Do you realize that it is entirely likely that after the death of Jesus Christ, even though Matthew 27 verse 51 shows that the curtain that separated that holy of holy areas was supernaturally into at the death of Jesus Christ, thereby showing that access to that throne room was now open to all. Not just the high priest, but it was a far different place that man could go to now. A far different area with a far different high priest available to everyone when God calls them. Hebrews 9 shows such detail with such a patient and encouraging explanation as only a good teacher could do, that there was this tabernacle. You know, after that time of Jesus Christ's sacrifice, it is entirely likely things continued on in the Jewish community the way they had been for many, many years since the time of the people coming back from Babylon. That is, that the sacrificial system continued on. You and I look back, why would they do that? Jesus Christ had come, been the eternal sacrifice for all. We know that. But they didn't. They weren't looking to Jesus, as it says later on in the book, the finisher of our faith. They hadn't gotten to that point. The author is explaining that all of that has been superseded now. That sacrificial system is ebbing away. The key that they had not latched onto yet was that Jesus Christ, after the order of Melchizedek, who was the God of the Old Testament that appeared to Abram, that Abram paid tithes to, as this book will show you if you read it in chapter 7, that Jesus Christ, that God, remains back on his throne, having ascended after the resurrection. The main topic of this book is so elevated and so majestic and so inspiring. It's intended to lift the audience of the mid-first century to the point where they would not be deceived by the heresies of that day, as well as help them to rise above what they had previously been taught under the Old Covenant, and help them to understand that something has replaced what they were brought up with. The key that unlocks the knowledge of this book and helps the reader back then and even today is the understanding of who and what Jesus Christ was and is. At the end of the book of Deuteronomy, check it out. Well, I'm going to read it. I just can't skip over this. Hold your place there. We're coming to a close here, I promise. Hate to go this long, but Deuteronomy chapter 34. Deuteronomy 34 and in verse 7, verses 7 through 12. At the end of his life, it now says, Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were not dim, nor his natural vigor diminished. Boy, we'd all like that, right? And the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. So the days of weeping and mourning for Moses ended. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the children of Israel heeded him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. The ending of this book, or the prologue of this book, was probably written by Ezra after all of the major and so-called minor prophets, and he was putting everything together at the end of what we call Old Testament times. Ezra, probably the one that wrote these last few words tacked on to this book of Deuteronomy. And he was able to look back over the span of thousands of years of God's people trekking from the wilderness, from their very origins, from the Garden of Eden, and say, but since then there is not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. Now turn to the book of Hebrews in chapter 1, or chapter 3. Hebrews 3 and verse 1 says, therefore, holy brethren, again, very encouraging, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, Christ Jesus, who was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was faithful in all his house. For this one has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he who built the house has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, But he who built all things is God, just as John 1:1-3 says. And Moses indeed was faithful in all his house as a servant, as a testimony of those things which would be spoken afterward. But Christ as his son over his own house, whose house we are, if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm to the end. Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 1 says that Jesus Christ is the express image of the Father. Verse 2 has in these last days spoken to us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the worlds, just as John, the Logos, who being the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person, and upholding all things by the word of his power, all the science, all the physics, all of the laws, natural and physical, created by this one, having become so much better than the angels, as he has by inheritance obtained a more excellent name than they, because he divested himself of his Godhead, became human, and died as the ultimate sacrifice. And Hebrews 2, verses 10 through 12, show the clear differentiation between the created beings of surrounding the throne room of God and this Jesus Christ. Our high priest is Christ Jesus. Those who were the Hebrews of the first century were called upon to become teachers. They had to understand the difference between the old and the new covenant. They had to accept Jesus as God. They had to realize that there was no need for continuing this sacrificial system, which only pointed to Jesus Christ anyway, to his ultimate sacrifice. And they had to understand his role as the God of the Old Testament, the one who met Abram and accepted his tithes, the one who, as he shows, allowed that transition from Melchizedek to the Levitical priesthood, and then now back to the successors of that Melchizedek priesthood. And now the one who had died and forgiven the sin of all mankind with that eternal willing sacrifice, you're going to find it all right here in the book. Study it, read it. We may not have the same issues today in life, but like them, we are all called to be teachers. I have every confidence in every single one of you that you are going to be a great teacher. And you're probably a great teacher right now, to be honest with you. You probably already are there, but you're going to be so much better than that in the kingdom of God.